1, 2, 3, 4.
I'm fascinated by the extremes of the human experience, partly because it is so far away from our own experience of life, in a way. But in another way, actually, when you look at people who have neurological disorders or diseases, these are really nature's experiments. They are ways of trying to understand how the brain works for all of us. Looking at these extremes, whether it be sleep disorders, neurology, epilepsy, it tells us about the workings of our own brains, how we regulate our emotions, how we move, how we experience the world. I never intended to be a storyteller. I intended to be a story listener. And of course, that's what we do day in, day out in our clinic. But also through the telling of these stories, you create empathy, you create understanding, and you hopefully inspire the next generation of individuals to take up the torch because you engender a fascination with the brain in the same way that Oliver Sacks did with me.
Dr. Guy Leschziner is the author of The Nocturnal Brain, The Man Who Tasted Words, and other books. He's a consultant neurologist and a professor of neurology and sleep medicine at King's College London. He sees patients with a wide range of neurological and sleep disorders and is actively involved in research and teaching and has presented series on sleep and neurology for BBC World Service and Radio 4. His latest book is Seven Deadly Sins, The Biology of Being Human. Guy Leschziner, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thanks very much. It's lovely to be here.
So we've really been enjoying your body of work, your most recent book, Seven Deadly Sins, The Biology of Being Human. So much of what your life's work from your books, The Man Who Tasted Words, The Nocturnal Brain, really touch on things that are at the core of what we're interested here at The Creative Process. You've written about, you know, synesthesia and so many sleep disorders. What can extreme neurological conditions teach us about the human mind? And what drew you to this line of work?
Well, I'm fascinated by the extremes of the human experience, partly because it is so far away from our own experience of life, in a way. But in another way, actually, when you look at people who have neurological disorders or diseases, these are really nature's experiments. They are ways of trying to understand how the brain works for all of us. And by extrapolation from looking at these extremes, it tells us about the workings of our own brains. And that's very much the case across all the areas of the work that I do, whether it be sleep disorders, neurology, epilepsy, how we regulate our emotions, how we move, how we experience the world.
You know, you actually write these very compelling case studies that I think they really are in line, like Oliver Sacks or Freud. I mean, they really draw you in. However, they're really compelling reads. What from the Seven Deadly Sins, but also from your other works, what were the stories, the life experiences that stay with you the most? Like, this is so fascinating.
Well, I think the honest answer is that all of them. And the reason is that these are stories that have stuck with me that really do demonstrate the extremes of the human experience. They all tell us about different facets of our experience as human beings, whether it be how we sleep and our experiences in sleep, how we perceive the world, how we understand the world that we inhabit, and also how we behave. So that's a really difficult question as to which one of those really stands out. I guess they all have huge impact on the people who are living with these conditions.
Well, can I say some that stuck out to me that I found, and maybe you can expand upon
it? Sure.
I mean, on the Seven Deadly Sins, we bring up interesting questions of biological determinism. So whether it's a deadly sin that we call envy, Sarah had a conviction that her husband was cheating on her, but then you find, oh, well, actually she had this condition. And you touch on maybe like violent aggression is not just related to epilepsy, you know. So it's very fascinating to say, where does it come from, this neurological disorder? And then also I want to say that you also question these ideas of like normal and what's outside of the normal, because this is like the norm is always changing. But those were some just from Seven Deadly Sins. But I liked some of these sleep disorders, like the sleepwalking or sleep acting, like a 70-year-old woman who had to give away her motorbike because she was actually riding it in her sleep. That's potentially dangerous, but very amusing.
I think it was less amusing for her at the time, but in hindsight, I think she saw the comedy in it. So, you know, I think if you take her as an example, that really gives us a very clear representation of the weird and wonderful things our brain does, even if our brain is overtly normal. Because, of course, she doesn't suffer from any damage to her brain. It's not like she's had a stroke or has multiple sclerosis or any of these other serious conditions. Essentially, what she is experiencing is a glitch in the system, so that her brain can exist in two stages of wake or sleep at the same time. That her brain, in part, remains in very, very deep sleep, but in other parts remains wide awake. I mean, clearly, your brain has to be functioning in part on a very normal level if you're able to ride a motorbike or drive or reverse parallel park, even when you're asleep. So I think that her case gives us a very valuable insight into what is going on in our brains when we sleep. If we talk about some of the other cases that you've mentioned, one of the cases that I describe in Seven Deadly Sins is the circuitry that goes to influence our lust, for example, so our sexual desire, and how all these various neurological conditions that affect certain areas within our brain can influence not only the degree of our sexual desire, but also the nature of our sexual desire. And, you know, a crucial aspect of this is, I know you talk about biological determinism, and, you know, that's very much the viewpoint that I come from. However, the other thing that I really try and stress is that our brains change throughout our lives, and that they're influenced by environmental factors, be that within the womb when we are developing, or in childhood, or even in adulthood, that our brains are not fixed in stone, that they are malleable, and so therefore are at the influence of the environment that we inhabit. It's a combination of nature and nurture.
Yes, although I have to say that some of your work could be used by unscrupulous people talking about the item of lust. I think I saw a meme recently where someone said he wasn't cheating on his partner, but he had bodily ADHD.
Well, I think that those two things can coexist. One of the major thrusts of Seven Deadly Sins is to say we perhaps need to think of bad behavior in a slightly different way, but that doesn't negate personal responsibility. It doesn't negate the criminal justice system. It doesn't negate the moral codes that guide us in our lives. These two viewpoints can coexist.
Yes, and you talk about these extraordinary things that some of us who have that kind of sleepwalking or do when we're not aware. The body is awake, but the mind isn't. They don't remember it afterwards. But it really makes us question, as you also write about, like free will. I mean, it makes you ask, like, when you're awake and you think you're making decisions and you think those decisions are yours, how much are you actually awake? Are you being manipulated? Are you now with like social media and AI, are you being further nudged to have more extreme reactions? So it's, we think that we're the animals of reason and we have all this control, but in some ways we're kind of like the birds that flock together and follow the seasons and can be very easily manipulated. And as we know, neuroscientists, and I know you're a neurologist, but have been used extensively in the creation of AI and social media. So yeah. There's also many good. That's just a dark side of it.
I guess that to consider that we don't have free will in everything that we do runs completely counter to our own experience. It's a horrendous thing to imagine that we don't have free will in any decision. But what's quite clear, and it's not just neuroscientists who believe this, there are obviously schools of philosophy who also believe this, that actually free will is illusory, that actually none of us have free will. Now, that's not necessarily a view that I particularly buy into, but I certainly think that all of us have influences on the decisions that we make and the acts that we undertake that are entirely beyond our control.
And on another note, just talking about, because you study sleeping and dreaming, it's been said that because of this abundance of distraction and technology around us, which is always on, that it's affecting our ability to sleep, focus, dream, and function. So I wonder what your reflections are on that. AI with its perpetual state of wakefulness has hallucinations and errors. And are we headed towards that as we become more like our machines?
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting question because actually there remains quite a lot of controversy as to whether or not we are sleeping less now than we did 50 or 100 years ago. And I think there's a great deal of disagreement on that. One of the things that you have to remember is that obviously that nowadays we all sleep in very comfortable beds in centrally heated houses, and our sleeping environment is much more conducive to sleep than when we are sleeping on animal skins in caves. So there are differences perhaps in the quality of our sleep as well. What is clear is that the use of technology is not particularly conducive to good sleep for everyone. And if you do suffer from a tendency towards poor quality sleep or limited sleep in the form of insomnia, then actually technology is very bad for you in many respects. But that's perhaps not the case for everyone. So do I have concerns about technology and its impact on sleep? Absolutely. Do I think that it is leading the human race into a hallucinatory destruction? The answer to that is no, I think.
Yeah, and I think that there are obviously benefits now with AI and with imaging. Some of the people that you study, their behavior is happening when they're sleeping. It's hard for you to interview them, right? Mm. And I think that they don't remember it afterwards. So does some of this advances in technology, would that help you unlock those mysteries?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the reasons why we have made such leaps forward in understanding sleep is because of the technological advances. And undoubtedly, AI is going to help that process. One of the things that we find very difficult is to extract subjective experience from individuals who are sleeping. It's almost impossible. We have to rely upon other modalities like imaging, electrical activity, a whole range of other techniques and technologies in order to interrogate the human brain. And AI will undoubtedly have a role in all of that.
And so I want to ask, quite kind of personally, because I've been always someone who, I don't want to say suffered, I thought it was a kind of a boon, but I've always had so many dreams. And people have told me, oh, it's because you didn't have a good night's sleep. But I remember them in great detail. And I'm often like going to so many countries and too many people. I feel like I don't need virtual reality. I think this interface, which is my brain when I'm sleeping, is...
Yep. Yeah.
But I'm wondering, I like to find, you know, other artists, of course, have found inspiration from their dreams or it's a kind of lucid. What of your examination of the dreaming life, its role, the role it plays in creativity? I mean, you just unpack that a little for us and tell me, is it a bad sign that I dream so much?
So an online consultation.
It's free medical advice.
I think the first way to answer that is, you know, generally speaking, we tend to remember our dreams when we wake up from REM sleep. Actually, you know, we do most of our dreaming, particularly the narrative structure type dreams, where there's a plot evolving in a stage of sleep called REM sleep, although we can also dream in non-REM sleep as well. But these kinds of narrative dreams, the ones that we will often say, oh, you know, I dreamt about this happening last night, and then I walked down the road, and then a tiger jumped out at me, those kinds of things occur from REM sleep, but we typically only remember them when we have brief awakenings from REM sleep. So vivid dreaming is often a feature of inherently unstable REM sleep because, you know, there are people who we record overnight who exhibit, you know, several hours of REM sleep, but because they don't wake up during REM sleep, you wake them up and they say, oh, I didn't dream anything last night. You know, it's very rare for us to actually do studies whereby we don't see any REM sleep, but actually people saying I never remember my dreams is actually quite common. So the question therefore is, well, what is the impact of that? Well, I think for most people, as far as we can ascertain, there is no particular downside to that, except if those dreams have a very strong emotional content. And if they have a very strong emotional content, you know, particularly if it's negative, then we tend to characterize that as nightmare disorder. And that can actually, firstly, be associated with conditions like anxiety or depression, but it can also be associated with previous psychological trauma. What we think is going on is that generally during that stage of sleep, adrenaline levels or norepinephrine levels in the brain drop dramatically. And that enables us to remain in REM sleep. But if you have a predisposition to having those areas of the brain that are high in adrenaline or noradrenaline, then the emotional content of your dreams is so high that it actually wakes you up. So just to repeat that, basically, if your emotional content of your dreams is very high, then that is more likely to cause an awakening from REM sleep, and therefore you're much more likely to remember your dreams or nightmares.
All right. Well, I was also wondering, because I don't find them emotionally troubling, and I usually just sleep fairly easily, very quickly. I did wonder maybe when I started having, I mean, it's been forever, strongly in narrative dreams, that they were fascinating to me as an artist writer. And I wondered, oh, did I train myself to remember them? And then I was having them, you know, so it's a vicious cycle of analysis, like which caused the chicken or the egg in your clinic.
So it's interesting what you say about creativity and your virtual life, because I do have some patients with a condition called narcolepsy, where they will often go straight into dreaming from wakefulness, and their dreaming sleep is very disrupted, who say that they have alternate lives at night, that they live a parallel life at night to that which they live during the day. And they have much more freedom in that nocturnal life, and they very much enjoy it, and would actually pay a lot of money not to lose that as part of the treatment for their narcolepsy. And you also mentioned the fact that there are lots of artists or musicians who have sought inspiration in REM sleep, in dreaming sleep. You know, there have been lots of songs, lots of works of art that have been created inspired by some sort of dream experience. So there's clearly something that happens in sleep that leads to the breaks coming off the creative process. There are parts of the brain that we suppress during waking life that are unsuppressed in the night.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I mean, obviously, there's some people who can, or they could say as well, that they did naughty things like rob, not as a burglar. I mean, there's these things, or they could be hypnotized to do things. And that's another interesting topic, you know, about hypnotism and how pliable we are. And there was one who when he told a joke, he fell asleep right afterwards, which I thought, how bad are these jokes, actually? But it's just, the mind is endlessly fascinating. So I don't have to wonder what drew you to this. And you get to work at a very interesting end of it. You know, there's a lot of developments now from Neuralink, and people speculate about talking about the future of neural implants. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are of that. I mean, you know, what that will do to us, you know, transhumanism. Just, we're so willing to change ourselves. I mean, we're just readjusting our aesthetics all the time based on AI.
I think it's always been human nature to push at the boundaries, and there will always be individuals amongst us who really want to try and push the boundaries much harder. It's difficult to know what implications technologies similar to Neuralink will result in, but certainly there are a cohort of individuals with neurological disorders who would undoubtedly benefit from the ability to regulate certain aspects of their physical functioning, bypassing the bits of the body that are broken. So people, for example, with spinal cord injuries. The question is really, how far can we take this based upon current technology? And I think that at the moment, we are already at the limits of current technology. It's also important to say that, look, our understanding of the human brain remains pretty primitive, despite the billions of dollars and the number of people around the world who are trying to really understand the human brain. Do we understand how it acts as a whole? No. Do we understand what the nature of consciousness is? No. Do we understand, going back to a conversation that we were having earlier, what free will is and whether or not it exists? So I think that there are, you know, major obstacles to being in a situation whereby we can, for example, plug a chip into our brains and have a memory bank, for example, or change our abilities in any major ways. But the technology is very exciting, and I think I may be completely wrong, and actually in 50 years' time, we may all be walking around with a chip implanted in our brains.
Yeah, and because there's an element of, you question like biological determinism and on this topic of sins, you know, whether you could, if you could prevent crimes, you know, which I think it must be a little bit mixed as well, because it's the environment you grow up in as well, and the people you learn from. But I mean, I could see that some could make the case for that. I mean, there was that Philip K. Dick book. You talk about us being on the edge, and where do you think we'll be in like 5-10 years time if these rumors or if these technologies come to fruition?
So, you know, I think that with all of these technologies, and I think Minority Report is a really good example of that. You know, what if we could predict the future? There are obviously the scientific constraints, but then there are also questions that we as a society, not necessarily the scientists, need to answer, which is whether or not any technology is going to be used in a way that is in keeping with the ethics, the morality, the standards of the age that we inhabit. And of course, one of the things that we've seen is that ethical standards have changed throughout human history. And it may be that actually our ethics, our ethical code, is influenced by the technology that we have to hand. And that's why future gazing is so difficult, but it's also why it's so interesting, because there are unknown unknowns about the nature of our society in 50 or 100 years.
Yeah, and I'm wondering what your reflections are. I mean, we're living in a very interesting time, you know, technologically, but also politically. And we've seen the rise of populists. And I mean, Trump is a prime example, but we've seen others around the world, celebrity politicians who are using, you know, say some skills that you might observe in terms of neuroscience and communicating with people. And it's just kind of turbocharged at this moment in time. So this is just me wondering out loud, because I had a conversation the other day with the father of VR, Jern Lanier. And he said to me that he thought that Trump was a victim of social media.
I'm not sure I quite understand that. He's a beneficiary.
He's a master.
Indeed.
He's a master.
Yeah. I think the theory was that
he drank the Kool-Aid or whatever. And so he displays the paranoid state of, and the hyper, you know, you get this social media, and this is something you might have seen as well. You know, the hyper, always on, paranoid, willing to believe the worst, and a kind of aggressive at a, you know, at a moment's notice, that the social media addicts can get. So I'm just wondering what your reflections are on that, and how, you know, in this age, I don't know, just reflections on politics and neurology and neuroscience.
Well, I think undoubtedly society is becoming more polarized now. And I think that one of the major issues is that the, you know, in the olden days, nation states used to be tied together by a common narrative. If you look at the common narrative that ran through the United States or the UK or some other countries during the Second World War, there was a common narrative, a common view of how individuals who were citizens of that country saw themselves. And of course, one of the things that social media has enabled, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I think I'm fairly ambivalent to, is that that common narrative has disappeared. And now there are various strands of narratives. And we select the narrative, or we have the narrative selected for us, that most chimes with our worldview. And what that does is it causes a divergence of worldviews, which I think is perhaps in that context is unsurprising that we have become more polarized, because we're constantly getting our own views reinforced by the social media that we take in. One of the things that I talk about in The Man Who Tasted Words is how all of our realities are somewhat different. They're related to the experiences that we've had to date, our genetics, what we have learned, the cultures that we inhabit. And so it's important to remember that everybody's view of reality is different. But I think that what social media has achieved is in actually expanding those differences.
And we're coming up in a little ways down the way to the 100th anniversary of the rise of fascism in the last century. And you are you discuss it at the beginning of Seven Deadly Sins. You're the child of Holocaust survivors. And so I just wonder what your reflections are of that, and how, you know, your upbringing, you were born in Germany. I'm wondering how your upbringing influenced your view of the world and also your pursuit of neurology.
I think that what's going on in the world is very deeply worrying. You know, I worry for my children. I worry for society as a whole. I'm hoping that the pendulum will eventually swing back, you know, because that's what's happened in human history, is that the pendulum has swung from one extreme to another. But yes, it is very, very concerning indeed. I think that, you know, my upbringing was atheist, but it was in a very kind of almost Germanic Lutheran kind of view of what was right and wrong. And I think that that's very much fueled some of the life choices that I've made, very much with a view to kind of making the world a little bit better. I'm not saying that I have made the world a little bit better, but I think that that's what we should strive for, that it should be beyond personal gain and should be for making society a little bit better. And I try and do that through my work as a clinician. So I think that that was in part my inspiration for becoming a doctor. You started off very early on in this interview about talking about Oliver Sacks. I remember reading The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat as a 15-year-old boy and thinking that this was the most fascinating book that I had ever read. It raised concepts of what it is to be human in very neurological terms in ways that I had never truly considered before. And I must admit to my interest in neurology and neuroscience being triggered by books like Oliver Sacks, which in some ways was the inspiration for me turning my hand to writing as well. I don't think I do it as well as him, but if one person reads one of my books and thinks, oh, this is a fascinating area that I want to pursue, then I'll have done my job.
You've been compared to him many times. And I think your book, The Man Who Tasted Words, is a little bit of a nod as well.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Not a bad comparison. I think what's nice is that by describing these more extreme conditions, that you just bring an overall curiosity and also gratitude. Oh, well, thank God I didn't experience that. Thank God, you know. But what underlines this other little quirk that I experience or I've observed in others? Hey, Jaden, I believe you had a question for Gaia.
So hi again. I first wanted to know, with just like essentially given your experience with such a vast range of sleep disorders and studying them, as far as the rare disorders go, what do you think is the importance of things such as, I had read some of your work with catathrania and studying those sorts of more rare disorders as far as advancing our understanding of sleep in the brain and maybe what those might offer that we might not get with typical insights from studying more common sleep disorders?
Well, I think a really good example of that is narcolepsy. So narcolepsy was very much a mysterious condition until not so long ago. We kind of knew that what happened in narcolepsy was that people had difficulties controlling the switch between wake and sleep and dreaming sleep and non-dreaming sleep. But over the last 20 years or so, we understand the origins of narcolepsy very, very well. We understand that it's related to the loss of a particular chemical within the brain that stabilizes that switch between wake and sleep. And if you then think about, well, what implications has that got for all of us? Well, actually, this is the origin of an entirely new class of sleeping tablets, because, you know, by simulating narcolepsy chemically overnight, the drug companies have manufactured a sleeping tablet that is very effective for many, many people, I think. The other obvious example is when you look at what the consequences of disrupting your sleep long term are. If you have somebody with very disrupted sleep, then you can understand those consequences in a much shorter time frame. So if, for example, you look at individuals who've got obstructive sleep apnea and you see what the repercussions are of having your sleep disrupted many times an hour, and you look at the long-term health repercussions of individuals with obstructive sleep apnea, then that gives you some insights into what the effects of disrupted sleep are for all of us.
Absolutely. I think that's very insightful, just as showing how those more isolated cases can tell us more about just our traditional sleep for people who don't have these abnormalities within their own sleep patterns. So I guess kind of building off of that, regarding your book, The Nocturnal Brain, I noted that you had mentioned a lot about sleepwalking and just in general, how certain individuals kind of have different parts of their brain which are awake while others are asleep. I know you mentioned, I believe it was the cingulate cortex and then the prefrontal. So given this, like, how might frequent sleepwalking episodes kind of disturb someone's ability to decipher between their waking states and their asleep state?
Well, I think that the answer to that is that wake and sleep are a spectrum. So we know that actually even whilst we're awake, there are little areas of our cerebral cortex that seem to simulate sleep. So whilst you and I are chatting, there are small areas of both of our brains that are probably dipping in and out of sleep. And even when it comes to sleepwalking, you know, sleepwalking is a significant spectrum as well. There are individuals in whom they do some very, very simple things, like they may sit up in bed, look around, and then go back to sleep. And then there are individuals who might prepare an entire meal, who might, as we've already talked about, ride a motorbike or drive a car in their sleep. And I think that this spectrum behaviorally also reflects the spectrum from a neurological perspective, in that, you know, if you imagine that the amount of brain that needs to be awake in order to ride a motorbike, to be able to see hazards, to follow the signs, to navigate, to be able to stay balanced on a motorbike, that requires quite a lot of brain power, quite a lot of waking brain power. So the way that I would view that is actually for those sorts of individuals, the majority of their brain is awake, but it's the bits of their brain that are responsible for memory, that are responsible for perhaps a small degree of rational thinking, because of course, riding your motorbike at 3 a.m. with nowhere to go is not the most rational thing to do, is at one end of the spectrum. And then there are individuals who will just sit up or mutter something in deep sleep, whereby a very small part of their brain is awake.
So in those cases where majority of their brain is asleep, do you think that that is causing more harm to their brain's health in the long term for these people who are having a lot of activity while they're asleep, since sleep is supposed to be something that drives a lot of important functions for our bodies to grow and develop?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. But what you have to remember is that for the majority of sleepwalkers, I use the term very broadly as to cover all of these kinds of conditions, they will have infrequent events. So, you know, the average sleepwalker will have an event maybe once a month, once a week. It's pretty unusual to see people have these kinds of events on a nightly basis. And they generally tend to be relatively short-lived. And so for the majority of individuals with sleepwalking, they spend very little time in this brain state. You know, there are some individuals with sleepwalking who do experience significant fatigue during the day, and it's quite clear that there is an impact on their sleep quality. But that's certainly not the case for most of them. I think probably a better example are individuals who have sleep disorders whereby their sleep is being disrupted every night, sometimes many, many times an hour. You know, conditions like sleep apnea, as I mentioned, or periodic limb movement disorder. And we do see the long-term consequences of those kinds of conditions in terms of the association with dementia, association with heart disease, with stroke, with a whole range of other negative health consequences.
You know, it's so fascinating, these blended states. And it makes me think of your other book, The Man Who Tasted Words. And this subject, again, we were touching on a little bit of synesthesia. We hear a lot about that from musicians and poets. It's like we could, it's right there. It's blended all the time. But you've met some really interesting synesthesias who, like, they could taste the flavors of words. Like Tottenham Court Road has a flavor. I mean, I don't know what exactly is going on there, but it really hints that our combination of our five senses, that reality can be in some sense a lie of the senses for the sake of like efficiency.
Yeah. Synesthesia covers a broad range of phenomena, but at its core, perhaps the most striking of the features of synesthesia is this ability for different senses to be merged. And some people, as you say, can taste words, other people can see sounds. So one of the people that I describe in that book is actually a concert pianist. And when she plays certain notes, certain keys, certain chords, she sees colours in her vision, or she feels sensations over her body that are associated with that music. And what all of these individuals, I think, reflect is that our reality is entirely a function of how our brain works, and that, you know, synesthetes have normal brains overtly. There's nothing wrong with their brains. It's just perhaps that their brains are hyper-connected, and their experience of the world is very different from our own, which I think on the one hand is entirely magical and I think must give you a very different and more full experience of life, but at the same time can be very distracting indeed. But you can understand why individuals with synesthesia are perhaps slightly more gifted creatively. And, you know, the number of synesthetes who are writers, who are poets, who are musicians is very high indeed.
his research into different neurological disorders, like those relative to sleep, Dr. Guy Leschziner fuels the ongoing conversation of how studying conditions like narcolepsy not only enable us to better understand brain functions at the abnormal level, but further provide us with the means for driving medical innovation. An example of this which stood out to me was his explanation of how individuals with narcolepsy, a once poorly understood condition, struggled with controlling their transitions between wakefulness and sleep. It was only in the past 2 decades that researchers were able to identify that narcolepsy is primarily onset by the loss of a specific chemical, as Dr. Leschziner outlines. This breakthrough led to the development of new medications that have helped to revolutionize the knowledge of sleep and its implications, providing those with narcolepsy and those with general sleep disruptions with the means for managing their health and their bodies. This example and others like it, whereby sleep aids are bred out of the studying of abnormal sleep disorders, highlights the ways that studying extreme cases of neurological dysfunction can provide profound insight into normal brain function. By using their research platforms to hone in on these more unique conditions, researchers are able to reverse engineer our brain's mechanisms and understand how sleep disruptions of all kinds can impact our overall brain health. Dr. Leschziner's description of how chronic sleep disruptions can be linked to major health problems like dementia, Parkinson's, and heart disease is especially moving for me, as these conditions don't just affect sleep. They can impair cognitive function, memory, and overall health of our nervous systems. As a psychology major with career aspirations in neuropsychology, I, Jaden Van, and others like me can find inspiration and purpose by interacting with the works and knowledge of Dr. Leschziner. And now, back to the interview.
Well, it really makes us realize that all of life or all of perception is a kind of metaphor. Like we talk about symbolic language, you know, language creates a picture in our mind. It just reminds me, there's something very beautiful about creativity in the human mind. We're constantly inventing stories.
Well, I would say it slightly differently, creativity of human minds rather than the mind, because I think that one of the things that hopefully my books illustrate is that everybody's mind is different. And that, you know, one of the amazing things about the human experience, and indeed that manifests in terms of art and creativity, is that when we have such different minds, that is why all this creativity, all this art is possible.
It makes me think as well. I mean, it's not something that I think you can study or we can ever really know, but of non-human animals, they have a whole other sensory experience with lights and colors or vibrations that we can't even sense. So it just makes it that, what is their reality? So the reality is not singular either. You mentioned sometimes these kind of conditions or episodes that can be found as like indicators for diseases that may appear down the road, like you mentioned Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And I know that's not your particular focus, is that? But, you know, what this is something that concerns all of us, is like Alzheimer's and some of these other conditions. There's some new findings on it, and I don't know what to believe. So if you could expand upon that.
Yeah. You understand now that there are conditions of sleep that are very clearly predictors of some serious neurological disorders. And I think the best example of that is a condition called REM sleep behavior disorder, whereby people start acting out their dreams often in their 50s or 60s, because normally we're paralyzed when we dream. But in those individuals, that neurological mechanism of paralysis doesn't work properly. And we used to think of that as being just one of those quirks, or, you know, one of these interesting phenomena that we see in individuals. But what we've understood in recent years is that these kinds of conditions are often the prodrome to conditions like Parkinson's disease. Sometimes they can precede Parkinson's disease by up to 30 years. When it comes to Alzheimer's disease, there is a lot of literature that suggests that there is an association between poor sleep, insomnia, conditions like obstructive sleep apnea, and the development of Alzheimer's disease. Now, there are a number of potential explanations for that, but one of the really major focuses of research is the identification of a waste disposal system within our brains called the glymphatic system. And that waste disposal system's capacity for removing toxins or proteins from the brain actually dramatically increases in deep sleep. So if you disrupt your deep sleep, you disrupt the function of that system. And that can result in the buildup of certain proteins or molecules. And one protein in particular is one called beta amyloid, which is heavily implicated in the development of Alzheimer's disease. So if you disrupt sleep, then it may be that you get an increased buildup of this protein and might predispose you to Alzheimer's disease. There are other potential explanations as well, in that maybe that actually poor quality sleep, unstable sleep, inability to sleep, may be part of the prodrome of Alzheimer's disease in the same way that acting out your dreams is the prodrome to Parkinson's disease. And particularly alarming to doctors who have a tendency to prescribe medications, there are also associations between a lot of the medications that we give for sleep and Alzheimer's disease. Now, of course, it's not entirely clear whether or not these drugs might contribute to Alzheimer's disease or may simply be prescribed for individuals who are at higher risk already. But there are all these different strands of evidence that are pointing in slightly different directions. And at the moment, that remains rather unclear. It's actually a major focus of research at the moment.
Yeah. And what if your studies and writings taught you about the nature of memory? And you talk about not having quite accurate memories or being kind of a creative process.
Yeah. Sleep is really important for memory. We think that one of the primary functions of sleep is to consolidate memories, both in terms of autobiographical memories, but also in terms of emotional memories. One of the theories about why we dream is to try and clean up our memories and rid them of their emotional content, which is why some researchers have termed REM sleep, dreaming sleep, as being overnight therapy. And one of the other interesting theories about why we dream is that actually what we're doing while we're dreaming is actually tweaking our model of the world, because the brain really works not simply as an interpreter of our senses, but actually works in a rather more complicated and interesting way. It works as a prediction machine. So we expect what we're going to see, we expect what we're going to experience. And it's only when our senses are telling us something different from our expectation that we have to tweak our expectation of the world. It's difficult to do that when we're awake because we're taking in all these impulses from around us. But actually, when we're in dreaming sleep, when we're offline, that's the time to integrate our experience of the day into that model of the world that we have. And it's that sort of adjustment of how we understand the world to be that may be what's going on in REM sleep.
And you've written about very early memories are interesting. And you wrote about your first memory being orange. And then you just weren't sure. But just tell us that story.
Yeah, so if I think back to what my earliest memory was, it was the color orange. And I couldn't, for many years, work out why that might be the case. And, you know, it was only when I saw a picture of myself in a pram in Germany and I could see the orange PVC of the pram that I thought, I think that's probably what I'm remembering. But even now, I'm uncertain. You know, I think we're all familiar with the fact that our brains are creating memories as well, or adjusting memories, and that we may all have false memories. The past is also dependent on how our brains work.
And we should also say, I mean, we've just been focusing on your books, but you're a storyteller, a presenter. You've presented programs on BBC Radio 4, BBC World Service on the mysteries of sleep, the senses, phantoms in the brain. You go from the listening and storytelling process one-on-one with patients, and then you write your story in written form. But, you know, what have these different storytelling processes taught you about communicating, you know, medicine and science? And
well, I think the first thing to say is I never intended to be a storyteller. I intended to be a story listener. And of course, that's what we do day in, day out in our clinics. We listen to people's stories, we write them down, and we try and understand their stories in order to achieve diagnoses and to give treatments. That was always my intention. But you know, it became apparent later on in life that the telling of stories for me is as powerful as the listening to stories, because it's through the telling of stories that you communicate with a whole range of individuals outside your immediate clinic room, is the first thing. But also through the telling of these stories, you create empathy, you create understanding, and you hopefully inspire the next generation of individuals to take up the torch of going to be doctors and psychologists, all these other healthcare professionals, because you engender a fascination with the brain in the same way that Oliver Sacks did with me.
And who have been these other, you know, teachers or mentors or collaborators who kind of helped you become the neurologist, writer, educator you are today? and also in your general reflections on the future of education?
Well, I think that there are, you know, in medicine, we tend to have an awful lot of mentors. So we go through our training and we are exposed to a huge number of senior doctors who we like, don't like, respect, disrespect. And, you know, that's one of the joys in that you can choose your mentors or who inspire you. And there have been many, many people over the years who I have looked at and thought, gosh, if I grow up to be anything like him or her, then I will be very satisfied with my career, because there are some hugely intelligent, kind humans who I have worked with, you know, many more intelligent than me and much kinder than me. And so these do provide significant inspiration. There have obviously been those individuals who have put themselves in the public eye, many writers of the kind of books that I write, many educators who have been deeply inspirational as well. I think that there is a bit of a, I don't know how much of this is central to the UK and how much of it is a worldwide problem, in that education has become much more of a business than it was when I was being educated. And it's much more of the relationship between the educator and the educatee is a little bit more transactional. It's a bit more consumerist. And I think that that's obviously good in a way, because it maintains certain standards, but it's perhaps bad in other ways, in that you lose the old star relationship between mentor and mentee.
Yes, I think that that's definitely true. But there are many ways, which is wonderful, that we can learn outside of the classroom. And one of those ways is through your books and programs. And we've been discussing a lot now, you know, inner landscapes, the beauty of the human brain and mind, imagination. But now, as we like, perhaps could you reflect on this outward environment? Because many speculate that our disconnection with the natural world causes us to be, you know, lose inner harmony and calm and focus. So, I mean, I guess if you could share your reflections on the beauty and wonder of the natural world and why that is beneficial for our minds as well.
Well, you know, most of us live in a urban environment, which is busy, it's exciting, it's full of stimuli, but it's also dirty and noisy and distracting. And in many respects, that's a sort of wonderful place to live. But in other respects, it's not particularly conducive to calm, to relaxation, to mindfulness. And I think that there is an increasing body of medical literature that ties these kinds of mindfulness-based approaches to actually being quite good for our brain and physical health. And what we need to try and do, and I think that there are some countries that do it better than others, who regulate their urban environments better than others, that to introduce those aspects of nature, those aspects of calm, of green, an ability to step away from that busy, throbbing city, that I think will be good for our health. I suspect that we will focus much more on those aspects of urban living, of the urban environment in the future.
I think that that's so important. And then just in closing, as you think about the future, we've discussed education, but, you know, I guess there's lessons that have been important for you as you reflect on the kind of world we're leaving the next generation. What would you like young people to know, preserve and remember?
I think it's very easy to be very pessimistic about the future. But if you look at the world in general, if you look at the number of individuals who live lives that are easier, that are better fed, that have better access to medicine, that have better access to a clean environment, to clean water, you know, those improvements have been ongoing continuously forward through the generations. And actually, as a whole, as humanity on this planet, I think people are probably leading much better lives than they were even in the last generation. I look at my children and I think about the world that they inhabit, which is a little bit kinder in some respects. I know that there are issues, but actually it is a kinder world. It's a world where, you know, the kinds of things that we saw are not acceptable anymore. If you look at the developing world, the global south, things have improved dramatically across many countries compared to when we were growing up. So I think the key thing is not to lose hope and not to be pessimistic about the future, because pessimism becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I think that's true. There are many reasons to be cheerful, or maybe grateful is the word. So thank you, Guy Leschziner, for sharing your insights into the brain, sleep, and perception. By examining the extremes of the human condition and the nocturnal mind, we can better understand our dreams, senses, and what it is to be human. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Jaden Van, with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Katie Foster and Jaden Van. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram at Creative Process Podcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.